female business leading. But I'd like to introduce you to and reintroduce you to. Some people here have been introduced several times to him, but maybe some are hearing him about him for the first time. Dr. Paul Brand, a British surgeon, orthopedic surgeon, who began his career all the way back actually treating patients during the Blitz in London in World War II, and then moved on to India, as his parents did, to become a missionary doctor, establishing an institute in Vellore that he then tended leprosy patients in that institute for the next 50 years till his death. He's brilliant, a brilliant surgeon, but also a brilliant scientist and a brilliant theologian. That last part he would challenge you on. He'd say, no, those are just devotions that I have with my staff, and they are some of the most brilliant theology of somebody who loves and serves Christ all his life. He turned down the dean of Oxford Medical School twice in his career to stay in Vellore and treat those with leprosy. He invites us today to consider an alternative world without pain. In this world that we talk about how painful it is to live here, what we don't understand and we don't realize after being conditioned over thousands of years of living with pain and our aversion to it and our instinct to avoid it, he says, I'd like you to look at pain a little different. As we've been doing this new year, looking at power just a little different, looking at worship a little different and the reasons why we do. But he asks us to consider an alternative world without pain. He insists on pain's great value. He holds up as proof the terrible results of leprosy on his patients, the damaged faces, the blindness, the loss of fingers and toes and limbs, all which occur not directly to the disease itself, but because the disease attacks the neurons of your pain sensors. It actually happens because of the absence of pain. Most all of leprosy patients' damage happens because they cannot feel pain. As a doctor in India, he made the groundbreaking medical discovery that leprosy does its damage merely by destroying nerve endings. People who lose pain sensation then damage themselves by such simple actions as gripping a splintered rake or wearing tight shoes. Pressure sores form, infection sets in, and no pain signals alert them to tend to the wounded area. I thank God for pain, Brand declares with the utmost of sincerity. I cannot think of a greater gift I could give my patients than the gift of pain. He went on to describe the intricacies of pain system, how the pain system protects the human body. It takes firm pressure on a very sharp needle for the sole of the foot to feel pain, whereas the cornea of the eye senses 1/1000th as much pressure, calling for a blink reflex when a thin eyelash or a speck of dust even brushes the surface. Intestines don't sense pain from being cut or burned, something that does not naturally occur on the inside of someone's body. But dangers these internal organs don't confront, they send out the urgent pain of colic when distended. We doctors experience a rude awakening after medical school, Brand continued. After studying the marvels of the human body, suddenly I was thrust into a position much like the complaint desk of a department store. Not once did a person visit my office to express appreciation for a beautifully functioning kidney or lung. They came to complain that something was not working properly. Only later did I realize the very things they complained about we're their greatest allies. Most people view pain as an enemy, yet as my leprosy patients prove, it forces us to pay attention to threats against our bodies. Without it, heart attacks, strokes, ruptured appendices, stomach ulcers would all occur without any warning. Who would ever visit a doctor, ever, without pain's warning? I noticed the symptoms of illness my patients complained about were actually a display of bodily healing at work. Virtually every response of our bodies that we view with irritation or disgust, and by the way, invent over-the-counter medications to do away with, blister, callus, swelling, fever, sneeze, cough, vomiting, and especially pain, demonstrates a reflex toward health. In all these things, normally considered enemies, we can find a reason to be grateful. So a new way to look at pain, along with everything else that goes with living on this planet, with living under the rules of what goes on under the sun. Wealth, prosperity, pain, suffering, grief, and most of all, wisdom and power, and all that it plays into the paradigms of power that you and I are confronted with every day. Do we live by the rules of power in this kingdom, or do we live by the rules of the kingdom to come? According to the Qohelet, according to the Ecclesiasticus, Solomon writing down all of the wisdom that he had, exhibiting and dabbling and being involved in the power of the world and the power of the kingdom itself, he said that it vexes us under the sun. He's explored it all, he says. He shared with us as he reflects back. He confesses for us, and he still is reaching for answers, even with all the wisdom in the world contained within him. So chapter 8 in Ecclesiastes, if we want to continue just a little bit, is where he thinks it should all begin and end with everything under the sun. Who is like a what? Who is like a wise man? Notice by chapter 8, he's still clinging to his what? To his wisdom. Who is like the wise man who knows the interpretation of a thing? I like that. Just knows the interpretation of a thing. Not dream, not word, not just a thing. Being wise makes one's face shine, but arrogance changes one's face. Wisdom is what should guide the journey and provide the answers. It should even provide joy for the hardness of our faces. It starts as what seems to be a continuation. Remember, he began by saying, I asked for wisdom. God gave it to me. I wanted to rule as wisdom. That's where we began the last week. So it sounds like chapter 8 is a continuation of that, but it's different because his proverbial wisdom will take a turn for all of us here. He says, keep the king's command, and because of your sacred oath, do not be terrified. Go from his presence. Do not delay when the matter is unpleasant, for he does whatever he pleases. At first blush, it seems to think that the wise thing to do is to obey the powers that be. It's a wise thing to do, he says. It seems to be a wise thing to remember. But remember, he operated in those corridors. And he's trying to tell us there are dangers lurking in that proverbial wisdom. There are dangers lurking in the corridors of power in this world. Actually, what he might be asking us to consider, he may be very well trying to tell us that wisdom, for all its advantages on this planet, might not save us from the trouble when confronted by royal power, by absolute power. He told us last week that his wisdom lost every time. And he was the one in power. For the word of the king is what? It's powerful. And who can say to him, what are you doing? Whoever obeys a command will meet no harm, and the wise mind will know the time and way. So it seems, again, to be wise to obey the king's command. But why? Because you'll meet no what? You'll meet no harm. It's the safe thing to do. In other words, preserve what? Preserve yourself. Stay quiet. Stay safe. But what don't we consider when we assume that's what he's saying? When we assume that that's what wisdom will take us? I agree that earthly wisdom will take us in that direction. You cross the king, you face his sword. Right? So it seems. But the idea of self-preserving and staying safe, it says here, it says, for every matter has its time and way, although the troubles of mortals lie what? Heavy upon them. Every matter has its time and way, but our troubles lay on us what? Heavily. Indeed, they do not know what is to be, for who can tell them how it will be? We don't know, do we? We don't know the consequences of staying self-preserved and safe away from the power. We don't know the consequences of confronting that power. We don't know what will go on this planet. No one can tell us how this is going to turn out. Uncertainty, fear, danger, that is the problem with that proverbial wisdom. Is that fear, that danger, that uncertainty that we have of not knowing what tomorrow will bring, unfortunately, can be used very effectively by somebody in power. That fear can be used to manipulate people very easily. And no one better than somebody who has an ultimate power in the sword, an ultimate power as a king. This nullifies wisdom at every turn. Fear of uncertainty. Fear of harm. Fear of death. Fear of coercion. This nullifies wisdom every time. Because we forget who's talking here. Does he know what he's talking about? Of course he does. You have a king actually trying to tell us what went on in those corridors of power. He's letting you know what happened. He's letting you know what he gave into. Did he give into his wisdom of wanting to serve God? Did he give into all of that? No, he ultimately did what? He gave into the power and he used it. He's confessing that to you right now. He's telling you how far wisdom will take. When wisdom comes up against our fallen natures and our fear and our uncertainty, what wins out? He said, my nature is what wore out. Because remember what he said last time? He said, when I, the teacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem, I applied my mind to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to humans to be busy with. The wisdom writer here, the Kohelet, the collector of sayings, was actually the king that he's referring to. Not just any king, but ruling over God's people, placed on the throne by God, ruling God's nation, if you will. Remember how God ultimately felt about Israel having a king. He told Samuel to tell him, you don't want a king. We want a king. He says, no, you don't want a king. Remember a couple weeks ago, because he will take, he will take, he will take. I use it four times because that's how many times Samuel said he will take something from you. Your sons, your daughters, your wealth, your prosperity. You guys don't want a king. Samuel tried to warn him. Solomon seems to understand that, and he thinks He had a solution, remember? Give your servant, therefore, what? Understanding mind to govern your people, able to discern between good and evil. For who can govern this great people of yours? I truly believe Solomon wanted to make a difference. He believed he could make a difference. He believed he could prove Samuel wrong about what a king could do. He believed that his wisdom could transcend the demand that a king will always put on his people. That a king, he believed he could be more than somebody who will just live out his own selfishness on the backs of the people that he rules. He thought he could make a difference. Just give me the wisdom to do so, Lord. He asked for it, and what? He got it. Was it the solution? Was Israel's throne and Solomon's rule protected from the corruption because he was wise? Did it work? No. If you think it did, you've never read 1 Kings. And how did he feel about it? Remember his wisdom? I thought it would give me the answers, and he said what? It vexed me. He said, it vexed me. It caused heartache and pain. And he had to come to this conclusion. Eventually, I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had spent in doing it. And again, it was all what? It was all vanity and chasing after the wind. And there was nothing to be gained under the sun. So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the king's successor do? He can only do what? Only what has been done before. Wisdom, nature, power on this planet, power of the coming soon celestial planet we will be living on. This one wins out. Worship at the time. Worship at his time. Said that religious power and the monarchy should come together. It can't be stopped, right? His opening of his kingdom after he finishes the temple is that he is standing at the altar. He presents the sacrifice, which, by the way, violating every rule of the sanctuary. Solomon's not a priest. He doesn't come from the priestly tribe. But you all wanted a king. You all think that this king can be different. So, let's make him a religious and a powerful king. He's the one giving it. And everybody there that day, they thought they were witnessing something grand. But we all forget what happened, right? Eventually, the humans were all chased out of the temple. God's presence showed up. And his presence drove everybody out. We're convinced that God approved this because the king told us so. Notice, nobody notices the dangers that are coming. Is it a good idea that an entire nation be forced to worship God? No matter who that nation is, no matter who that God is. When it's all over, does God show himself to the nation? Does he ever speak to all of them? No, because that's not what they wanted. They were invited up. He spoke to them in Sinai and then invited them up in the presence. And they all said what? Uh-uh. We will live by intercessors. And they kept coming up with intercessors. First the priests, now what? Now they're kings. So when God speaks to Israel, he just comes to Solomon. Solomon complains in Ecclesiastes of how burdenful this was. Well, they asked for it. You asked me for it. I only come to you because that's what they want. He comes to Solomon alone to tell him what it's going to take. When we read through Solomon's reign, by the way, there, his meteoric rise and his stupendous fall, we notice a couple of things. And that is this, is that God came to him in the beginning. He rose to the throne. He fell immediately, and God doesn't come to him again until the end. And by the way, when he comes to him in the end, he comes to him to tell him about his successors. I'll rip the throne from you, but I won't rip it away from your family because I made a promise to David. That's it. Three quarters of those accounts, by the way, in between. Three quarters of his reign. Three quarters of the book of 1 Kings. It doesn't tell you the day-to-day governing. It pretty much spends its entire time telling you about Solomon's riches. That's it. There's only one narrative. It's about a foreign queen coming to witness what she has heard. And what has she heard? He's the wisest, and he's the richest, and he's the most powerful. So in a way, the narrative of the Queen of Sheba isn't really about her. It's about who? It's about him. And it really isn't about him personally. It's about his wealth. It's about his power. One thing this whole experiment as a religious nation has done is to convince the king that this under the sun's reward, because this planet rewards that power. This planet rewards that bringing together with wealth and prosperity and the absence of pain. No harm. It's good to know the king. And even we fall into the trap of saying that God blessed them. Was it a blessing, really? The Kohelet doesn't think so. The Kohelet, who's nearing the end of his life and has watched his physical power wane, he's still sitting on the throne, but he knows what's coming. He doesn't even call himself the king anymore. I'm now the Kohelet. I'm now the collector of sayings and telling you what I experienced. That isn't the blessing. None of it was a blessing. It all vexed me, he says. It all, the power and the wealth and everything else, it vexed me at every turn. Even though I had the wisdom to do something else, even the wisdom vexed me. The more I knew, the more I was vexed. So it sounds like we can come to a couple. Can we conclude? Are we willing to conclude that God rewards spiritual worship with material wealth? Are we supposed to believe that? A king say so. A king that is convinced and can convince his nation that God is on their side, he will and can use it to his own advantage. The power that be will always use it to its advantage. You have to see what Solomon is pointing out here. He says, no one has power over the wind to restrain the wind or power over the day or death. There is no discharge from that battle, nor does wickedness deliver those who practice it. All this I observed, applying my mind to all that is done under the sun, while one person exercises authority over another to the other's what? To the other's hurt. Who is the only one, by the way, that has the power to restrain the wind? God. He's comparing himself, his power, to whose power? God's power. One person, the king, exercises authority to another's hurt. How? By convincing him that these rules apply. That the rules here of power and wealth and prosperity and absence of pain and growing, that these rules apply to us. They apply to serving an earthly king, but they do not apply to serving obey God. We tell people when we mix up these rules. We told the world, hey, obey God, and you will be rewarded here. One of the reasons, we still sometimes, I say us as our elders, we still sometimes call for the offering by telling people, if you pay your tithe, it's going to work out for you. You're going to be what? I may have just stepped on some toes. Our treasurer's toes, definitely. I remember once an elder who had as much wisdom as any 10 people in this room and loved Jesus as much as 10 people in this room. There was a church member that was struggling with finances. He wanted some help to point it out. He wanted some help to get himself on track. And because he was a businessman, the elder was a businessman, he said, well, I'll help you. The very first thing that the elder asked the struggling member was, you need to start paying your tithe. What he didn't know was that he was a tithe payer. In fact, there were times where he paid double his tithe. But this elder just assumed, without ever looking at his books, that if you're struggling financially, it means what? You're not paying your tithe. Why does the world believe that if they worship God and do the right things and do what He says and obey, that they will prosper? We taught them that. The church taught them that. Because unfortunately, we worship God the way that Israel worships Solomon. By the way, even though that their wealth couldn't, these are his subjects who are in poverty. They believe that because Solomon is blessed, they still believe they're blessed as a nation because Solomon has all their money. And make it to where it really hurts, to take it out of the realm of money. How about those who are suffering? Subtly let them know that if you're suffering and in pain, that God's not very pleased with you. Rich, prosperous, suffering, not in pain, you must be a worshiper of God. See, under the sun's rules takes advantage of that kind of theology. Under the sun's rules takes advantage of that and manipulates one person to the other, manipulates one to another's hurt. The king laments this as the Kohelet, not as the king. He doesn't lament it. He never lamented as the king, but he laments this as the Kohelet. When I saw the wicked approaching to sacrifice, they go in and out of the holy place. They boast in the city that they have done such things. This also is what? This also is vanity. He says, I see the wicked, and they're what? They're obeying the rules. They're going in and out. They're worshiping God. They're doing what they were called to do. By the way, that word sacrifice is a strange kind of Hebrew to Greek word. It's interesting. One way to be able to put it is it's going into profane as concerns burial, if you will. I saw the wicked approaching to burial. In other words, they come to burial. So what's he saying here? The wicked are going to be praised at their funerals for being what? For being righteous. Because they obeyed all the rules. And they obeyed all the rules, and since they were doing that, God must be favoring them with all of their wealth, with all of their prosperity. And by the way, they'll get one more reward, and that is people will sit around after they die and tell you how good they were. Because nobody tells the truth at somebody's funeral, right? ultimate vanity, is it not? It's the ultimate vexedness of living under the sun. Because sentence against an evil deed is not executed speedily. Who are the ones that never have a sentence executed against them speedily? The one with the power and the wealth to do something about it. If I can still convince you that I'm a righteous person because I use my prosperity and my wealth to prove to you that I'm a righteous person, guess what? I can also do something about when somebody accuses me of doing something wrong. The human heart is fully set to do what? To do evil. Those sinners do evil 100 times and prolong their lives, yet I know that it will be well with those who fear God because they stand in fear before Him. But it will not be well with the wicked. Neither will they prolong their days like a shadow because they do not stand in fear before God. Evil deeds are not seen as evil when you have that kind of mask or that kind of veil of power in front of you. Standards are upended. The wealthy and the powerful are in God's favor. Then, of course, there's no sentences executed. There's a vanity, he says, that takes place in all this. Whatever you're going to conclude about who's righteous and who isn't, and whether or not you can tell by what they have and what they don't, and how they exercise their power, it's a vanity, he says, that takes place on earth. It's a vanity that there are righteous people who are treated according to the conduct of the wicked and wicked people who are treated according to the conduct of the righteous. I say that this also is even talking about who's wicked and who's not. He says even that is a what? He just wiped out about every philosophy class I ever took. Right? Because that's what we talk about in philosophy. That's what we sit down and look at. That's what Plato spent his entire life trying to teach us. Solomon looks at guys like Plato and Socrates and the Stoics and the Epicureans and says, vanity. Ultimately, addressing again this ingrained theme of living under the sun. That under the sun can teach us that the righteous suffer, and that the righteous don't suffer, and the wicked do. We've all wondered about this. We've all discussed this. He's weighing in on an issue that doesn't come down on the side of those in the past who have argued this. Let me ask you just a real quick primer on human suffering. As a church, are we supposed to subscribe to the myth that the wicked suffer while the righteous prosper? Do you open your mind to the possibility that pain and suffering can be a gift? That pain and suffering might be the exact way that God is rewarding your righteousness? See, if your faith is based on sinners suffer and saints do not, then you're arguing full tilt with the Word of God. Like I said, real quick primer on suffering. The Bible, by the way, is full of this imagery for us. Metal tried in the what? Metal tried in the fire. Not sitting in some sort of safe environment where no rust or anything can get to it. It's tried where? It's tried in the fire. Silver being purified by the refiner's fire. Branches that do not bear fruit are being what? Are being trimmed away. Thrown into the furnace where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Persecution, a cause for rejoicing when it's for righteousness' sake. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are the poor, the mourners, the meek, the hungry, the thirsty. Those who lose by the world's definition are actually having their strength strengthened. Because they're living by a different set of rules. They're living under a different power. The world believes that suffering is a punishment for sin and prosperity is a reward for faith. Why? Because it's the church that taught them that. We taught them that. See, if you must stand by faith to endure, and you believe that suffering is a punishment for sin or a lack of faith, then actually, when God is trying to strengthen your faith through your suffering, it will crumble. Our faith has to depend on something else than being earthly rewarded or physically blessed. Job taught us that. So at the end of our primer on suffering, you know what? It doesn't matter a bit in the context of the passage with Job. It's a moot point to Job as to whether or not who suffers and who doesn't. It's a moot point to Job whether or not who causes suffering and who doesn't. Job not only believes that God caused this suffering for him, he believed that he actually had a hand in it. He believed he did it. Not that he let it happen or anything else. Job said, "You did this to me." He tells him, "Will you not look away from me for a while? Let me alone until I swallow my spittle." By the way, he said, "You don't even leave me alone long enough to make some spit in my mouth." What does he want to do with that spit after he makes it? "If I sin, what do I do to you, you watcher of humanity? Why have you made me your target? Why have I become a burden to you?" Job represents the absolute best humanity has to offer. He worships God even though he believes God is his enemy. Our faith can only be genuine if it's selfless. It can't depend on only God's good gifts. If our faith is rooted in the righteousness that the righteous don't suffer, and we experience pain and grief, and we can't do that, where do we turn then for safety? Secular powers that be, those powers that claim to be speaking for God, how overwhelming is this to those who are suffering? It's one thing to say, "I've got the sword and I'm going to use it." It's another thing to say, "I've got the sword and I've got God on my side, and that's why I'm going to use it." It overwhelmed Solomon. This is his confession. He's a confessing king who did that very thing, and he knows it. He's pronouncing it an ultimate vanity and vexation. A couple years ago, I spent 17 weeks. I can't believe you let me go that long, but you did. Thank you. To talk about our supposed prophetic heritage and the knowledge of the dangers of believing that there could be a Christian nation. When the beast from the sea and the beast of the land are the dragon's ultimate manifestation of counterfeit churches, counterfeit worships, and counterfeit gods. You have a king here who is the wisest of kings ultimately in human history, and he's cursing this belief that there could be a believing nation. When belief is based on free will, and it's free of coercion, and it's free of fear, it's free of intimidation, it's free of faulty theology like, "Just obey God and he'll make you rich. Just obey God and you will no longer suffer." So as far as living here on this planet, now you know the context of one of the verses that are most taken out of context I have ever been across, taken out of context as one I've ever been across. Because Solomon's solution here on earth, then, to all of this is, "I commend, then, enjoyment. For there's nothing better for people under the sun than to what? To eat, to drink, and to what? And to enjoy themselves, being merry. For this will go with them in their toil through the days of life that God gives them under the sun." What have we turned that verse into? Don't eat, drink, and be merry. It's a sin. Taking it completely out of the context.
He said, no, don't give in to what the world is trying to teach you about God. Don't give in to what a king is trying to teach you about God. Eat, drink, and marry in that context isn't condoning or indulging sinful behavior. It's about being content right now with whatever lot in life we have. And by the way, if you're suffering and in pain and powerless and in fear, and that's our lot, those are the people that are supposed to be in here with us, because we recognize that and we can do it together. We could be a bomb in Gilead and not be sitting on the other side trying to figure out whether or not this disease has anything to do with your sin. Says, when I applied my own mind, my own wisdom, to see the business that is done on earth, how one's eyes see sleep, neither one, neither day nor night. I saw all the work that God, that no one can find out what is happening under the sun. However much they may toil in seeking, they will not find it out. Even though those who are wise claim to know, they cannot. Wisdom can't be then manipulated by power or by authority of a ruler under the sun. If we can somehow be content, even starving or persecuted, no one, no king, no priest, no pastor, no teacher, no leader, no anyone can ever manipulate you into worshiping God for reward. By the way, it's the only thing that short circuits the power of the beast. Short-circuit the power of the beast, if you remove the fear of being manipulated or coerced, you stand up for those who are suffering. You short-circuit that power here. It may not go well with us. If you are destined for captivity, then into captivity you shall go. Those who live by the sword will die by the sword. God invited the newly freed slaves from Egypt. He called them up the mountain to walk with them and to talk with them. Yet they cowered in fear and they demanded an intercessor. He was a decent enough guy, Moses was, wasn't he? He was holy. It seemed to be just what God wanted. But when he came back down after being with God, there was something about him. He was changed. Moses came down from Mount Sinai, and he came down from the mountain with the two tablets of the covenant in his hand. Moses did not know that the skin of his face shone because he had been talking to God. Notice the glory of God was not in the tablets. The glory of God was in who? It was in Moses. It's the relationship with Moses that is the glory of God, not the intercessory relationship that he had with his people. Aaron and the Israelites saw Moses, the skin of his face was shining, and they were afraid to what? They were afraid to come near him. So now even the intercessor that they sent up Sinai to go between them and God, now they're even scared of the intercessor. They're afraid of him because they're afraid of God's presence. See, our scripture reading, that's what it deals with. Our scripture reading says it brings all that fear and doubt to the surface that needs to be dealt with, because it's the ultimate statement of what God wants from his worshipers and what his worshipers keep trying to demand from him. They want the best of intercessors. We always do. The most holy and the righteous. By the way, when we start to worship power, we want the most holy, but we also want the richest. That's why we hold up Solomon as it. Remember I shared with you last week that even known commentators look and say this was the pinnacle of Israel's presence in history. They were never better. And Solomon writes Ecclesiastes a few years later saying, no, we were never worse. intercessors ever given. A priestly one, Moses. A prophet, Elijah. The best that's ever given. And what they don't understand is God saying it's the relationship. We believe we just need the right intercessors and the right definition of power and the right power to worship. But God puts a stop to it. While he was still speaking, suddenly a bright light overshadowed them and a voice came from the cloud and said, "This is my son, the beloved. With him I'm well pleased. Listen to him. Put away your fear of my presence. Here he is." Because Peter said, "Well, let's not have just one tabernacle. Let's have three now." Stepping further and further and further back from the actual relationship that God has been trying to give them for 4,000 years now. They heard this, they fell to the ground, they were overcome by what? By fear. But Jesus, the presence of God, comes and he touches them. And he says, "Get up. Don't be afraid." And when they woke up, suffering a strengthening of righteousness. Power is only to the meek, the humble, the hungry, the thirsty, the persecuted. Only having a face-to-face, walking, talking relationship with God through Jesus Christ, the presence of God that actually has a mouth that you can talk with and hear, and actually has legs you can walk with, and hands that can touch the fearful. Church grabs hold of that power and quit worrying about the other power. We could be those hands and feet. We could be that voice. He's all in on love, by the way. There's no other way. Not even the slightest dabbling in this power or fear of coercion or anything. Not a slightest dabbling into allowing political power to do our mission. Nothing like that. Love is all in. We either love or we don't. Real power suffers no compromise. Real power